These last 5 years or so have been rough going for a lot of people. Among them have been those who think of themselves as occupants, more or less, of the middle of the road. The unzealous, the bipartisan, the considerers of arguments on their own merits. Compromisers. Can't we all just get alongers? So polarising have these times been that even some of those who might, in less crazed and febrile times, have been considered ideological outliers, appear suddenly reasonable. Our special guest this week is PJ O'Rourke, the journalist, foreign correspondent and satirist who made his name as a conservative contrarian in the 1980s and 1990s, gleefully winding up the liberal subscribers of Rolling Stone and writing best-selling books including Republican Party Reptile, Give War a Chance and Peace Kills. O'Rourke became, if possibly despite himself, the favourite conservative of American liberals, while being about as much a liberal as American conservatives could stand. His latest book, A Cry from the Far Middle, Dispatches from a Divided Land, finds O'Rourke, if not exactly standing athwart history yelling stop, then at least flailing gamely at the onrushing tide of dogmatic foolishness with the broom of measured reason, and not once does he mangle a metaphor nearly as grotesquely as that. This is the last episode of this program, which will be broadcast before O'Rourke's fellow Americans make a fairly fundamental decision about what their politics is going to look like from here on. Can the centre ground be retaken? And is anyone still there? This is the Foreign Desk.
The anarchistic and nihilistic point of view that is common at the end of the teens and the beginning of the 20s and on for those of us who matured very late, reality will shake you out of that. I mean, anybody who tells me they're an anarchist, I'll invite them to revisit Mogadishu with me. Let me show you what anarchy, you know, really means, you know. Now, on the other hand, the sort of like armed nitwit Trump supporters maybe should have had a little go at Northern Ireland back in the 80s. If you want to see where that road leads, if you want to take that road all the way down to the end of that road, Belfast was a enlightening experience, as were the Balkans and so on. So all that like goes to mitigate one's absolutism and certainly one's anarchism and nihilism.
PJ, welcome to the Foreign Desk. This episode may end up appearing as either the last signal before the ship sinks or the fanfare, perhaps, of some new dawn. And we need to frame our conversation accordingly. Indeed, find a middle ground, which I think is appropriate to certainly the theme of your new book. The title, A Cry from the Far Middle, does seem to bookend Republican Party Reptile from 1987 to an extent. But the question is, can the middle ground be made to sound at all sexy and exciting?
No. Short answer. Short answer.
Well, thank you for joining us, PJ O'Rourke. Do tune in next week.
That was a quick interview, a frank answer. And a one has been looking for a certain amount of honesty in politics. I just saw something the other day. I saw the first honest yard sign that I have seen over here in the States during this election campaign. It said, settle for Biden. You know, if it weren't for the pandemic, I would have gone knocked on their door and given them a big hug.
But is there a way you think that centrism can be made to sound at all exciting? Could there be a centrist party Reptile?
Yeah, it would be very tough. But, you know, I just want to go back to us fighting in our usual way. I don't want to put an end to our quarrels with some sort of sweet and mushy kiss on both cheek. We'll all be friends from now on and forever. No, I want to go back to a good, strong fight between the left and the right. The trouble is that the fight has gotten away from the issues, you know, the quarrel. It's one of those things like a good old family feud. Coming from an enormous Irish family, I am plenty familiar with those. A good old family feud where the cause of the anger is long forgotten, you know, and people are just screaming and yelling at each other and threatening each other and misbehaving in general. We went through a period where the left and the right really had to confront themselves. They had to confront the failure of communism, which is leftism taken to its greatest extreme. The left had to confront the failure of that. They had to confront the failure of their socialist economies in Western Europe and in the UK and so on. The right had to then confront the fact that it was much less fun to actually be in power under Reagan and Thatcher than it was to be standing outside, pressing your face against the window, making grimaces and obscene gestures. And, you know, it turned out that the free market, lovely thing though it is, it doesn't solve all our problems magically either. So we had to fight that out, but it's now been so long ago since we had those substantive fights that we've forgotten how to argue. So my comparison, I don't think I actually put this in the book, but I mean, I've been thinking about it since, is that our political arguments have ceased to be real political arguments about real issues. That is to say, you know, do we increase the scope of the national health, improve its funding and operation, or do we modify it, means test it, give a little larger scope to the private sector, blah, blah, blah. Instead, it's one of those things, like anybody who's been in a marriage or a partnership, it starts out with, shall we re-slip cover the sofa? And it ends up with, and then there was that woman you were flirting with at that party in 1991, to which the other half of the partnership responds, I hate your mother. I've never said it out loud, but I hate your mother. You know, it's because, you know, and here we are.
When you talk about going back to a period when there was more substantive debate, can you recall a time when that was actually still the default setting of the discourse?
Oh, yes, absolutely, vividly. I mean, I think from the time of the sort of failures of Keynesian economic theory in the 70s, the sort of failure of detente, then the wholesale failure of the Russian communist orbit, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the post-Cold War hopes that we all had for some, dare I say it, new world order, where everyone would, to some degree at least, would cooperate with each other. There were good old fights back then, both the United States and Britain. We ended up changing our welfare systems to a certain extent. Found out that there was no magic cure for that. I mean, there was lots of arguing and screaming and yelling going on, but without the rancor, the hatred, the despair, and the utter lamentable earnestness that we're feeling about all that these days.
In the period immediately after that period you're describing, the end of the Cold War in the late 1980s, which some rather hubristically chose to characterize as the end of history, and there was immediately following that on both sides of the Atlantic, sort of what now seems kind of a golden era for centrism, Clinton on one side, Blair on the other, a period about which I'm sure you don't personally have any great nostalgia, but comparing to what we've got now, did we maybe not realize how good we had it?
Yeah, no, I don't think we did. I think we were already beginning to get distracted by things like Monica Lewinsky. You know, I mean, that set off a furor in the United States. That was an interesting sort of precedent, a little sort of a dry run. Perhaps dry run isn't the phrase I'm searching for, but you know what I mean. That was a sort of peek at the script for the kind of hatred that would emerge a number of years later. Yeah, here we are with a very democratic president, Bill Clinton, married to an even more democratic wife who had a plan for everything, as the left always does, a government plan for everything. We've all, of course, got plans for everything. And he's saying, you know, the era of big government is over. And you had Blair, you know, with the new sensible socialism that wasn't actually very social, you know, that would actually allow for free market forces to be. Yeah, it was great.
But if we think back to the Monica Lewinsky scandal as kind of an exemplary scandal for what would follow, is it the fact that people, or at least a plurality of electorates everywhere, got more excited by scandals and dramas associated with politics than they were by actual politics?
Yes, that's absolutely exactly what happened. And of course, it's partly us, the media, who is to blame for that. And although it was forces outside your or my control, certainly, all of a sudden you had this internet thing. I keep waiting for that fad to blow over. But anyway, all of a sudden you had this internet thing. Of course, that had been preceded by that cable TV thing where you had to fill 24 hours of news 7 days a week. And if you actually did that, if you really performed the prescription, if you're talking about floods in Bulgaria and outbreaks of flu in Kazakhstan and, you know, various problems that they were having with anthrax and ponies in Mongolia, but no, needing to fill up 24 hours with news, the far more attractive thing to do, the thing that would get you more views or more clicks or whatever more things you wanted, was scandals. As long as those were limited to celebrity scandals, that's probably all well and good. Who cares what happens to them anyway? But of course, political scandals were very inviting. Thank you, Bill Clinton, for giving us the script on that. Yeah, so forces outside our control also drove a large portion of the electorate into the idiotic positions that they occupy today.
Because something shifted there, hasn't it? People were, rightly or wrongly, scandalized by the Monica Lewinsky scandal, whereas it often occurs to me now that people aren't scandalized by scandals, and in many cases they should be. They're actually entertained by them. They enjoy them.
Yes, yes, scandals have teams. And that, too, began with Monica Lewinsky. We should have been rightly shocked by Monica Lewinsky, as my wife at the time, and who's still my wife, pointed out to me. I'm going, well, this is like sort of sleazy, you know, but I'm old enough to remember Jack Kennedy, so it's not the first time that sleaze has entered the Oval Office. She said, no, Kennedy fought in his own weight class. The gals Kennedy palled around with, they were grown-ups, and often rich, attractive grown-ups with resources of their own. This was a teenager, you know, and perhaps not the best balanced teenager in the entire world. And she's like an unpaid volunteer for the most powerful man in the world. So as my wife was, you know, who's not a raving feminist, but she made the very good feminist point, quite rightly, that it wasn't just about cheating on your wife here. This was about a gross imbalance of power between the two sexual partners, something that really could only be viewed as predatory, and the man should have been frog marched right out of office on character's issues. But instead, we got Team Republican, let's impeach him. I mean, you know, a decent person would have resigned. The spouse of that decent person would have chased him out of the White House and leaving him over in Lafayette Park across the street with no place to go except to resign. But at any rate, instead we got Team Democrat and Team Republican, and people began cheering for the two sides in this. And like I say, a foreshadowing of things to come.
Have you ever, when reflecting on your writings and books up until this point, wondered if any of this is your fault in terms of creating that tribal dynamic between Democrats and Republicans? You spent a lot of the 80s and the 90s trying to make the Republican Party sound like they were the edgy and cool option.
Yes. In my egotism, of course, a good solid dose of guilt always contains a certain amount of egotism, you know, is that I have sinned so against the Lord as to imbalance the universe and bring down his wrath when he probably is busy elsewhere. Actually, not so much my mature writings would, again, not be the phrase I'm searching for. I don't think I have any mature writings. But I wonder if back in our National Lampoon days, which for your listeners, hard to describe, a sort of much more raw and raucous private eye, would that do that as a description
about right.
of the National Lampoon?
Yeah.
I mean, on slicker paper with more pictures of girls wearing rather less than the climate probably demanded. In the 1970s at the National Lampoon, I wonder if we didn't set off a sort of like cynicism, screw them all, everything is fixed. They're all jerks. There is no good side to support. Yeah, I wonder if we weren't in part authors of that attitude. We weren't alone, of course, by any means. And I don't want to make too much of that. You know, I think we were riding a trend. Saturday Night Live, of course, which spun out of the National Lampoon, actually, was originally conceived as a National Lampoon television show. And the corporate owners of National Lampoon thought NBC's offer money was too small. And so NBC said, well, the hell with you, we'll just do it ourselves. Anyway, and so most of the writers and performers in the original Saturday Night Live were from the National Lampoon. So that probably had a much bigger effect, Saturday Night Live attracting many more viewers than Lampoon had ever attracted readers. But anyway, you see the trend. Yeah, I confess to having been part of it.
I mean, the book, the new book, that is, it does sort of seem to suggest a certain softening of your outlook in many respects. You're quite sympathetic to the Black Lives Matter protests. You seem reasonably on board with taxing the extremely wealthy. You definitely seem on board with Americans not being bankrupted as a condition of ever getting sick. Do you think you have actually softened, or is there something about that burn it down nihilism that your once fellow conservatives seem to have embraced has driven you closer to the center?
Well, I think one, you know, life experience, you can speak to this. I mean, life experience gets the anarchistic and nihilistic point of view that is common at the end of the teens and the beginning of the 20s and on for those of us who matured very late. Reality will shake you out of that. I mean, anybody who tells me they're an anarchist, I'll invite them to revisit Mogadishu with me. Let me show you what anarchy, you know, really means, you know. And on the other hand, the sort of like armed nitwit Trump supporters, and there are some armed nitwits on the other side of the violent Antifa types, maybe should have had a little go at Northern Ireland back in the 80s. If you want to see where that road leads, if you want to take that road all the way down to the end of that road, Belfast was an enlightening experience, as were the Balkans and so on. So all that like goes to mitigate one's absolutism and certainly one's anarchism and nihilism. The other thing is a major change in our economy. I grew up fighting the ideological battles from one side or another because I spent my stipulated time as a leftist in college and shortly thereafter, and then went over to the other side. But I grew up fighting the political battles of the Industrial Revolution, not of the Electronic Revolution. Our economy has changed drastically, hugely, in a manifest way that I don't pretend to fully understand, but it does change one's opinion a little bit. And John Maynard Keynes, of whose economics I'm not a huge fan, but a very interesting, very smart man. And John Maynard Keynes was once tasked with being inconsistent. Some writer about business and economics said, you know, you're inconsistent in your views. And Keynes said, when my information changes, my opinion changes. What does yours do?
So, I mean, are there particular bedrock opinions you think you've changed in recent years?
Oh, no, I don't think so. You know, I've always been of a kind of a libertarian cast of mind, which is not really a political position. It's more of an analytical position. I mean, the core of libertarianism is individual liberty, individual dignity, and individual responsibility, of which, in my experience, everyone is in favor of the first two, and hardly anyone wants anything to do with the third. But at any rate, individual liberty, individual dignity, individual responsibility is still the sort of triple lens through which I view all politics. And so anybody who's coming to me, you know, asking to be elected or, you know, proposing a political plan, how does this affect individual liberty? How does it affect individual dignity? How does it affect individual responsibility? Are always the three questions to ask.
But when you think about those three principles, and I guess especially when you discuss them or see how your still reasonably young children are adapting to them, and these are kids whose perspectives and ideas find their way into your books pretty frequently now, do they have the same ideas of what those things mean that you do?
I think they do, but I think they have a much clearer view of how something like social media affects those three things. And I will say, bless my children's little heart, I may have my political differences here and there with, you know, vegetarian daughter and another daughter who's less understanding of Trump supporters than I am, and a son who's like at a very woke school and so is coming home with various woke catchphrases. You know, I have my differences with my children, but I think they understand those three principles very well. They're not really principles so much as they are, I mean, a principle answers things. These are more questions to ask. And I think they ask those questions, but they ask them in a much more informed way about something like social media, which, bless their little hearts, creeps out all three of them. They use it, of course, being the age that they are. But all three of them are creeped out about the privacy aspects and the intrusive aspects. And they're quite articulate about the way that social media allows you to instantly tribalize. You know, it used to take centuries to create, you know, the kind of mess that we had in Belfast. It took millennia to create the kind of mess that we had and still have to some extent in the Balkans. And even if you were just a lone nut and you wanted to stir things up, you had to go get a mimeograph machine and get your hands all covered with mimeograph ink and turn out your poorly worded page after page of pamphlets and stand on a street corner handing them out and carrying a soapbox to stand on to tell everybody the world was ending. And so it was a lot of work. Now, with a couple clicks of a finger, you know, anybody who's wrong can find a large and enthusiastic group of people who are even wronger on that issue.
Social media obviously has been a massive driver of the partisan rancor that we're, I guess, talking about trying to find a way around. I mean, there's certainly no way imaginable that I can see that Donald Trump gets elected in a world without social media. But I guess, again, especially talking to your kids, does it strike you that maybe we are learning how to live with it, much as previous generations of humans might have learned to tame and farm a wilderness they had recently conquered?
Yes. When printing was invented, what happened? The 30 Years' War is what happened, because the first thing that got printed was the Bible. And it turns out that no two people who read the Bible read it exactly the same way and get exactly the same. You'd think it was pretty straightforward. 10 commandments, not 9, not 11, just 10. There's 10 commandments, pretty clear. What Jesus said was pretty straightforward, love thy neighbor as thyself. But as it turns out, no, and certainly no in respect to the institutions that have grown up around religion, like the Catholic Church. So the invention of printing set off the 30 Years' War. And we must remember that as printing got cheaper and paper got more readily available and the technology got simpler, and we began to get a wealth of newspapers, you know, which we look back on and think, oh, wasn't that wonderful? There was local media back in those days, you know. But, you know, in the 19th century, we began to get a profusion of newspapers, and they tended to be violently partisan, terribly partisan. The idea of a sort of neutral news medium dates probably only to the founding of the BBC, really. You know, I mean, it's a fairly recent invention, and of course, it's now been uninvented, and its little golden period didn't last all that long. And I was just reading, have you ever read Len Deighton's Blood, Tears, and Folly? It's a history of World War II, but it focuses on World War II screw-ups, both our own and our enemies. It's a wonderful book, fascinating book, and it's really all about all the things we got wrong, you know, how we couldn't figure out radar forever, you know, and whether to convoy ships and so on and so forth. There was go-to-jail censorship in Britain during World War II. You print the government's version of events, how many German bombers were shot down. If you quibble about this and say, I'm not so sure about that. They said 40 were shot down, but we could only find 20 wrecks. You could be frog marched off to bread and water. To loop back to what we were talking about earlier, though, in the comparison to newspapers and, you know, other old fashioned legacy media, as they call it these days, we'll get used to this internet noise. We'll learn to sort it out. It may not happen in our lifetime any more than it happened in the lifetime of the people who fought in the 30 Years' War. But, you know, it will eventually sort itself out. It's just it's going to be a very painful period till it does.
Because you come back at the end of the book, at the risk of giving away the ending, to the United States founding fathers, in particular Benjamin Franklin.
Surprise ending.
In particular Benjamin Franklin, yeah. And George Washington. And especially Franklin's acknowledgement of the fact that because all political systems are built by fallible humans, those systems are going to be fallible. And Washington's extraordinary humility, first of all, in refusing to be anointed president for life, but also in his sign-off speech when he warns about the hideous follies of party partisanship. Is there any chance, do you think, of the United States from where it is now being able to re-embrace those lessons?
I do. I actually do. And one of the reasons that I do is that we have never had in the United States the sort of rigidly organized political parties with which you are pretty familiar in Britain. And of course, people on the continent are all too familiar. I mean, to be a Republican or a Democrat in America is really to belong to a sort of giant set of slightly contrasting attitudes. It's a Venn diagram that very often has historically had a lot of overlap to it. One sort of family of belief is the government should fix the problem. And then there's another sort of point of view, which is the government is the problem. And as we all know, when we experience government, we know we have to pay our taxes, and we know that there are certain government services that government should provide, and we're glad that they provide them. But, you know, down at the Department of Motor Vehicles, filling out ream after ream of bump in order to register a trash trailer, you can simultaneously be, you know, sort of thankful that the government, you know, builds roads and regulates them, decides which side of the road we should drive on, about which, incidentally, your country is wrong. And hey, I just toss that in. The government's doing all sorts of good things. We're glad the Department of Motor Vehicles is there. On the other hand, there's this ream after ream of bump we have to fill out. You can very easily hold in your head the idea government should fix the problem and the idea government is the problem. You can hold those two points of view without cognitive dissonance, without being neurotic or driving yourself crazy. And historically, America's been pretty good about that. Our parties are fluid. We have no membership card. You can't be, as you may have noticed from some of the people in our political parties, you can't be expelled from them. There simply is no way to do so. If you donate so much as a nickel to a Democrat or a Republican, you become a member of that party and can never get rid of your membership. And we'll be pestered forever and by email and mail and so on and so forth, and random telephone calls at dinner time. So we have this tradition of rather fluid set of political attitudes that it's not too hard to imagine that come back into better focus sometime in the future. But again, it may not be real soon.
Well, given all we have discussed then, and bearing in mind that at the time of this recording, we don't know what's going to happen on November 3rd, but if you take a medium to long-term view, are you still able to summon up what I still think is that most American of emotions and outlooks, i.e. optimism?
Yeah, I am. We've been through much worse. I mean, people will go on and on about it. America's so divided. America's never been this divided. And I'm going, hey, whoa. I am a child of the 1960s. And believe me, not only was America a lot more divided during the 1960s, with the horrible inner city riots going on, terrible fights against civil rights with the opposition and the support for the Vietnam War. And I said, not only did I endure that, you know, I in my own small personal way helped cause it. You know, I was out there screaming and yelling, dressed like a circus clown, protesting the Vietnam War with the best of them. And I said, you know, forget the 1960s. How about the 1860s? You know, and we had this little misunderstanding with our southern states. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed. Yeah, we'll go back, I think, you know, eventually to our normal level of disagreement and irritation with each other.
PJ O'Rourke, thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week with a special live episode looking at the US presidential election. And look out also for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. Our thanks again to this week's special guest, PJ O'Rourke. PJ's new book, A Cry from the Far Middle, Dispatches from a Divided Land, is published by Black Cat. The Foreign Desk was produced and edited by Yolin Goffin and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.